Questo podcast è stato realizzato nell'ambito del progetto PRIN 2020 REACT.
Buongiorno, ci rivediamo anche oggi. Qualcuno già conosce la professoressa Samantha Velluti perché è già venuta l'anno scorso e inoltre è membro del nostro collegio dei docenti, quindi è una nostra amica ben incardinata in Tor Vergata. Quest'anno poi addirittura è un visiting professor, quindi siamo molto, molto lieti di essere riusciti a fare rientrare, ecco perché stavo dicendo, in effetti Samantha è un esempio veramente tipico, ottimo, di cervelli in fuga e che noi forse vorremmo anche far rientrare, ma certamente almeno diciamo per questi eventi periodici che ci viene a visitare. E quindi quest'anno come visiting ci terrà due seminari. Questo è il primo, Climate Change and Forced Migration After Teitioa, Teotihuacan, è difficile da pronunciare, e si tratta appunto del problema di capire se dal punto di vista del diritto internazionale, in particolare dal punto di vista della protezione dei rifugiati, la posizione di coloro e anche delle popolazioni che devono spostarsi non per motivi di persecuzione, come nel caso dell'asilo, oppure di pericoli della salute o della integrità, nel caso della protezione internazionale, ma invece per il problema che le terre da cui sono originarie sono appunto oggetto di cambiamenti climatici che rendono impossibile o comunque molto difficile la loro permanenza nei luoghi d'origine. Quindi si spostano, ma non si spostano per appunto motivi diciamo politici, piuttosto si spostano per esigenze legate al cambiamento climatico, alla desertificazione, agli inquinamenti, oppure come nel caso Teitioa, addirittura per l'innalzamento delle acque degli oceani. Ecco, su questo appunto la Samantha Velluti ci illuminerà. Samantha, ho già detto qualcosa della sua origine. Samantha è italiana, si è laureata a Roma, alla Sapienza, però poi per un master e successivamente per il dottorato di ricerca ha frequentato invece università britanniche. Si vede che poi si è trovata veramente bene, che è rimasta lì e la sua vita anche accademica ma anche familiare ormai è tutta orientata al britannico. La carriera è stata brillante, tant'è vero che attualmente ricopre la qualifica di Reader in Law, che è quella succede proprio prima della professorship. Sì. E quindi insomma, possiamo più o meno recuperarlo anche forse un po' di più rispetto al professore associato italiano. È passato da alcuni anni all'Università University of Sussex, che diciamo, era un'università importante e diciamo, anche forse più prestigiosa rispetto all'università dove Samantha era in precedenza. Mi ha detto di avere una platea anche molto più ampia, sia dal punto di vista studenti che dal punto di vista strutture accademiche. Siamo quindi contenti che la sua carriera prosegua molto bene, come vi ho spiegato, ci viene a trovare ogni tanto, e questa volta ci viene a trovare parlandoci del climate change and forced migration. Prego.
Ok.
Sarà in inglese, naturalmente.
Sì. Well, first of all, I wanted to thank Professor Daniele, as always, for inviting me here. And it's wonderful to be a professor, to be on the other side, in the same university where I studied a few years ago, only a few years ago. So the topic of the presentation today, as Professor Daniele was saying, is on the topic of climate change, and in particular, forced migration as a consequence of climate change events. And the lens of analysis is the Teitioa decision of the UN Human Rights Committee. As I will explain shortly, there are very different types of climate change events, and so we must, in order to understand the impact on migration, we have to focus on particular regions or continents in the world to really appreciate the complexity of climate migration. And so I will start with a premise to provide the context of analysis to then move on later on to what the Human Rights Committee said, and to reflect on whether the international human rights regime, so complementary protection, is apposite to protect adequately climate-induced or forced migrants. So the first point I want to make is that there's now almost unanimous scientific consensus, including that of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that the increase in environmental disasters is displacing an ever larger number of people worldwide. And it's very clear to see that climate-induced migration and displacement is steadily on the rise. So, you know, even statistically, just to quote one, you know, the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center in 2020 alone said that more than 30 million people were displaced because of environmental disasters. And that has subsequently increased significantly in the last couple of years. And what is the problem? So why are we talking about it today? Well, the problem is that identifying adequate and effective legal and policy responses to deal with the effects of climate change on migration is very complex and challenging. And in part, this is because at the moment, as you might know, there's no legal recognition or protection of, or adequate protection of climate migrants or refugees. I'm sure you've come across different notions and definitions, and that also illustrates why it is so difficult. But I want to go first to the reasons why, which is not sort of a legal issue, but rather sort of an extra legal aspect. So we need to go to examining the nature of the environmental disaster that we are confronted with, and then the harm caused. And now we know that harm is crucial. You know, the real risk of harm, the severity of the harm, is really important. And I shall return to that in a moment. But the other aspect is, in relation to environmental disasters, also one of time and one of scale. So speed of change, and then the actual impact that it has on a particular community, a particular country. And so different scenarios in which people are forced to migrate or displaced because of extreme weather events can be envisaged, right? So we have two sort of main categories. We have rapid onset climate events, for example, earthquakes, floodings, typhoons. And what will happen here is that the displacement usually will be temporary, and also it will be internal. So what we will witness is internal displacement. Think about the floodings in Pakistan, for example, a few months ago, or the ones that occur in Bangladesh, or in general near the mega deltas areas, right? The Ganges, for example. In that context, we don't have really people crossing borders. We have people that stay within their own country. And so what we have is a different regime. So we don't have the Refugee Convention, rather we have the guiding principles on internally displaced persons. We then have another type of climate event, and that is known as slow onset climate events. And the most common ones are global warming, rising sea levels, droughts, desertification. And crucially, from a legal point of view, these do not pose an immediate threat to people's lives or to livelihood. And why am I stressing this? This is important from a legal point of view, because when these people affected by these kind of climate change events move, are forced to move, first of all, they leave their country, right? Because, I mean, if you can't, if you're a farmer and, you know, all your cows die, and or you can't cultivate the land, you can't stay there. So you move, and you move to other countries. And also, rather than being a temporary form of migration, it's also permanent. So people tend not to return to that country, because the prospects of sort of even adequate living standards are very slim, you know, are very low. And in this case, then, we have another form, another category of migrants. So they will be either classified as economic migrants, or if it's associated with forms of persecution that fall within, on the basis of one of the grounds of the 1951 Refugee Convention, then they might also be able to succeed in their asylum application, right? Because we know that in issues concerning land, it can lead to tensions, right? So, and then in turn, even in some instances, to conflicts. And so what does this tell us already? That from a legal point of view, we have different forms of migration for different reasons, and it's difficult to have a one-size-fits-all definition. And that, in turn, leads to problems of protection. You know, how should we protect all these different forms of human mobility? But also what happens is that we have also a hierarchy of migrants. So this is a problem. And going back to the Refugee Convention, as I will explain later on, some of you might know that environmental degradation does not amount to persecution, as defined in Article 1A of the Refugee Convention. There's also another side to this, and that is that it will also have specific impacts, so gendered impacts. Often, for example, women or children will be those who are more vulnerable and more negatively impacted by climate change. And the last point, which I want to make before sort of moving on, is the fact that there's also an asymmetry between so-called global north, so, you know, we could include ourselves, so Europe, and the global south. And that is because, as I'm sure you will know, the so-called least developed countries are the ones who are also least responsible for climate change-related environmental degradation. Right, so we hear a lot about that, particularly in relation to global warming. We know that it's largely countries in the global north who are contributing to rising temperatures globally. And so with this in mind, this is what I'm going to be talking about today. So I mentioned it briefly earlier, but I'm going to move on to that in more detail, the legal recognition and protection of climate-induced migrants, which is, you know, a long-standing issue. It's not a new legal issue. It's been debated since the 80s but with no sort of definitive agreement or consensus on a definition. There are different definitions, and I will possibly mention one or two. I will then look at, I will explain the deficiencies, the loopholes in the international legal framework, and how we can address these gaps in the law. But what I will suggest is also a different way of approaching the real risk to harm, you know, the severity of the harm. There has to be a different approach, as the Teitsiota case illustrates. And because, as I said, there are different types of climate change events, I'm going to focus on rising sea levels. And so I'm going to focus on small island developing states, or also known as SIDS countries, which are largely Pacific islands near either Australia or New Zealand. And in fact, the decision that I'm going to look at concerns New Zealand. And what is my approach? So here I've jotted down what my sort of approach is to this, to the examination of these issues. Not only legal, as I say here, but in my view, it also has to be one of environmental justice and of moral imperatives. And in particular, my lens of analysis is not just human rights based, but is also one that is narrowly focused on ensuring human dignity. What do I mean by that? I mean dignified living standards, right? Combined with a concept which is very important in environmental law, so this has existed for quite some time, and that is the common concern of humankind, which was first mentioned in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change of 1992. And recently, some scholars like Professor Courtier, who is an international economic lawyer, but also has an interest in looking at human rights aspects of international trade and international economic law, has recently come up with an idea of migration as a common concern of humankind. And I will explain why that is significant and has quite a lot of potential for climate migration. So I want to start with the problems associated with the international protection regime. Now, what are the problems? I mentioned earlier the fact that there are different types of migrations, different type of migratory flows. And one of the first problems that we encounter is the fact that it's very difficult to fit them in neat categories. You know, is it voluntary migration or is it forced migration? Now, the title of my presentation is forced, but not all countries will agree. So recipient countries, particularly in relation to slow onset climate events, will argue they're economic migrants. They decided to leave their country. And so that has already been questioned by many scholars. You know, it's, you know, whether it's voluntary or forced is very difficult to establish. And so the first solution is one of sort of removing old approaches and to stop applying the typical sort of single causal narrative in relation to migration. Okay. So people who migrate, I mentioned it earlier, will move for different reasons. And that is where the international human rights regime will apply, because, as I will explain in a moment, the Refugee Convention doesn't really work because I said it earlier, you have to show that there's a well-founded fear of persecution. And environmental degradation has not been found so far to amount to persecution. And it's even harder to then link it on one of the five grounds that are found in Article 1A. So, for example, when we hear particularly NGOs, right? So Friends of the Earth or Greenpeace, Human Rights Watch, for example, referring to environmental refugees, we might agree that they are seeking refuge from environmental disasters, but from sort of a traditional perspective of international refugee law, they're not refugees, right? And so this has moved the focus of analysis on humanitarian law and on human rights law, what is known as complementary protection. So so what we will have there are regional human rights regimes which can offer some level of protection in comparison to the Refugee Convention. And in fact, even before looking at human rights regimes, we can mention at regional level the African Union Convention on Specific Aspects of Refugee Problems in Africa, which doesn't replace, but it does have sort of a complementary definition of refugee, which is wider. It might offer some level of protection. Why am I saying this? Because it also refers to those who flee events seriously disturbing public order in either part or the whole of this of his country of origin or nationality. So we can see that compared to the Refugee Convention, it's broader in scope. We can also cite the Cartagena Declaration of 1984, which refers to those fleeing conflicts as a consequence, because of fleeing massive violation of human rights. So again, this offers some potential. Obviously, we need to wait for this, but we can see that climate change and forced migration because of climate change has gathered momentum in the last few years. So we might see some future cases in that direction. And I think the Teixeira decision, as you will see in a moment, offers some hope in that regard. This is my point, that there are some important legal gaps in the international refugee regime. And so the focus has shifted to complementary protection to international human rights law. But there are some problems there which I will address when I look at the decision of the UN Human Rights Committee. But moving on to more sort of theoretical problems, I want to start with the notion of refugee and go back to questions about harm. So so there are now quite a number of scholars who question the focus on the source of harm. So they question even the very notion of persecution. So and I sort of I am one of them. In my view, the focus should be on the severity of the harm rather than the source of the harm. And in fact, the question is, should we think of refugees as people who have had their human rights severely violated, regardless of the source of violation, and have been forced to flee their home country and seek international protection? So that is really a question that we should ask ourselves to ground our definition of refugee. And linked to that, so combined with the severity of the harm, should we focus on the vulnerability of people who are forced to flee? And relatedly, another question is, what form of protection are people entitled to in the case of failed states? So we can have scenarios where, you know, we know the persecutors are state actors, but also we have increasingly situations where non-state actors are the ones who are the source of persecution. And what is problematic, as I said, is the fact that people's insecurities are compounded by situations of extreme poverty. And so that is why I am arguing that we have to think outside the box, rather than trying to fit people artificially in a particular legal category. We have to realise that when we talk about climate migrants, there are different rights that are potentially being breached. So we can have a set of, civil and political rights, but increasingly what we have is a set of socioeconomic rights. You know, so when we talk about extreme poverty or extreme destitution, what we need to examine now, when we go to international and, for that matter, you know, European human rights law, if we look at the jurisprudence of the courts, we see that the threshold is very high. And so that makes it difficult for climate migrants to, for example, be able to rely, just to give an example, which we're all familiar with, Article 3 jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights, you know, when we talk about inhuman or degrading treatment, as we've seen in cases like MSS, where, you know, the Afghan asylum seeker was living in such appalling living conditions that the court found that there was a breach of Article 3 of the European Convention. So these are open questions. And in a more polemical way, we can also go back to, if we focus on Article 1A of the Refugee Convention, we know that even though on paper the criteria might be clear, de facto refugee determination procedures are left completely to national authorities, and the refugee status is often assigned in an arbitrary fashion. So refugees in identical circumstances will be granted that status in the courts of some nations, but see it refused in other countries. Even within the same countries, sometimes they will be granted asylum in some years, but not in others. And I just want to quote one example to illustrate this and the problems that the Refugee Convention raises. You know, think about if you've been following what the UK's approach has been in the last few years of creating a hostile environment, and more recently the interpretation of Article 31 of the Geneva Convention, specifically in relation to the notion of illegal entry. You know, all international refugee lawyers have said that the UK has been breaching the convention, and yet they have found a way of providing a counter argument for that. And so that raises issues of inconsistency as well. And we'll see, particularly with the Te Tioto decision, that what is key is the temporal occurrence of the harm. And that is why a number of scholars have criticized the classical approach of international human rights law, because they focus on the imminence of the harm. Now, the imminence of the harm cannot work with climate change, or better said, it can work with certain events, you know, flooding, earthquakes or fires, you know, for example. But in other instances, think about drought, imminence simply doesn't work. So an applicant will always be unsuccessful. And this again, I'm really stressing these points because it illustrates the multi-layered system that we are currently living in, and particularly from the perspective of forcibly displaced persons. The United Nations Refugee Agency, for example, uses a much broader definition than the one provided by the Refugee Convention. So they include all people it considers to be in refugee-like situations. And that includes even people fleeing extreme poverty. So these are people who face the same risks as refugees, but who are unable to gain refugee status for practical or other reasons. And this definition of the UN Refugee Agency is really useful because it includes refugees, asylum seekers, and internally displaced persons. So it removes that artificial demarcation that we have in the international refugee regime. Okay, and this brings me then to the case study. So I wanted to start with some facts. You might be familiar with them, maybe not, but I think it's important just to give a brief overview of so-called SIDS countries. So the map shows you where they are found. As I said, they're all in the in Pacific Island, in the Pacific Ocean. And I'm going to be focusing on one of them, Kiribati, which is an archipelago, and Mr. Te Tioto came from one of the very tiny atolls of Tarawa. And as you might know, they are exposed to increasing rising sea levels. And they have a series of problems that they're dealing with in relation to biodiversity and impact on livelihood has been already quite visible in terms, for example, of salted water now contaminating their rivers, their land, so they can't cultivate their land. And as I say here, what is problematic is, one, what I said at the start, is that they are responsible for less than 1% of global greenhouse gas emissions. But looking at, you know, people's lives, the problems that they've already experienced have caused a great degree of social unrest and violence in some instances. And that's something that Mr. Te Tioto has, in fact, raised, you know, in his various applications before then trying to reach out to the UN Human Rights Committee. Okay, so just to say who Mr. Te Tioto was, I said where he was from. So he moved to New Zealand a few years ago. Initially, he did have a visa. He moved there with his wife, and all their children were born in New Zealand. As it happens, they stayed after the visa expired, and there were no issues until they were caught. He was caught, you know, as it happens, for, you know, banal reason, you know, a traffic offence, and then that spiraled to, you know, a sort of disastrous situation for him and his family, because they discovered, the authorities discovered that he was irregularly staying in New Zealand. So then what he tried to do was to apply for asylum before the New Zealand Immigration and Protection Tribunal, which was rejected. So then he appealed before the appeal court of New Zealand, where again he lost. And not only he lost before the appeal court, but he wasn't even granted leave of appeal. In common law countries, you have to first, sort of the admissibility procedure requires that first you apply for leave before the court will even assess the merits, and that wasn't granted. And I just want to step there for a moment and examine why the New Zealand courts rejected Mr. Tetsuota's application, because that is really the really crucial aspect of what we are discussing today. Now, there are sort of two approaches to the notion of refugee. One is the narrow, strict notion of refugee, which we've been examining so far. And then there's a so-called sociological approach to the notion of refugee. And what the New Zealand courts did is that they applied a concept of persecution which refers to sustained or systemic violation of basic human rights demonstrative of a failure of state protection. So that is the notion that they applied. And some scholars, particularly sociolegal scholars, so the less sort of traditional scholars, legal scholars, they say, why can't this concept of persecution apply to those who flee their country because of climate change? You know, it is sustained because, you know, particularly in the case of rising sea levels, it is consistently increasing, and it is systemic. You know, it applies to a large part of the population. And also, it is particularly significant in the context of climate change, which is built upon the notion of collective agency and responsibilities for the effects of global warming. So the decisions of both courts, New Zealand has been criticized for the narrow connotation. So first of all, for focusing on a narrow approach to the notion of persecution, but also because it focuses on the individual rather than on the impact on, so the systemic impact on a collectivity of people should be the approach rather than the individual based approach. And some critics also say that these judgments also lead to a very perverse aspect, and that is that, according to their logic, if communities affected by climate change collectively and cooperatively seek to manage their situation and then claim protection, for example, under the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights or the Refugee Convention, then they're likely to fail. Why? Because there's no imminence, because there's no violence, no discrimination, no valid claim. If, on the other hand, they wait until the situation escalates so that, yes, there is discrimination, there is violence, you know, be it individual or generalized, then the doors may be open to them, right? So in other words, they have to wait until the situation becomes desperate. And that is perverse if you think about it, because it's suggesting that people should fight against each other rather than cooperate to try to mitigate the impact of climate change. Okay, so that's the sort of the critical aspects of the decisions of the New Zealand courts. Now, what did he argue? So, first of all, he argued that rising sea levels had made it practically impossible to carry on living in Tarawa. So, I mentioned it earlier, you know, farming became very difficult, and also supply of fresh water was becoming severely reduced. And he provided scientific evidence, not only by experts, but also that contained in the National Action Plans for Adaptation, which you might know countries have to already submit in the context of environmental governance. And so he used that evidence to sustain his claim, you know, to sustain the fact that he had to stay in New Zealand, he couldn't go back. So that's the premise. And so moving to the Human Rights Committee decision, now starting off with the significance, this is the very first sort of complaint application specifically in relation to climate change. So a claim for asylum made on grounds of climate change impact. Now, in a nutshell, I'm going to examine it in some detail, but in a nutshell, on the merits, he lost, but it's the reasoning that is interesting for what it might suggest for future cases. And in fact, a lot of NGOs have been very enthusiastic. Scholars have been less enthusiastic, but I will explain why, you know, there has been this mixed sort of welcoming of in relation to the decision. But on the merits, it was found that there was no violation of the right to life under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So Article 6 in particular, and then Article 7, which is sort of the non-refoulement provision of the covenant. So we need to understand why, but why there's still some hope. Now, this wasn't a unanimous decision, so I have included an excerpt of what one of the experts of the Human Rights Committee said. So I'll just read it to you. So he said, New Zealand's action is more like forcing a drowning person back into a sinking vessel, with the justification that, after all, there are other voyages on board. So, you know, really polemical, really critical. So this was a dissenting expert disagreeing with what the majority of the members of the Human Rights Committee said, established. Oops, yeah, there we go. So, so as I said, why did they think that on the merits there was no violation of the right to life of Mr. Te Tiota? Because as I say here, even though in terms of admissibility, he didn't have to show the imminence of the harm, so disagreeing with New Zealand, on the merits, the imminence of the harm did become important. And in particular, they also examined the scientific evidence, and they concluded that, you know, there were 10 or 15 years still left, and so there was no imminence of a real risk to the life of Mr. Te Tiota. But you know, I'm trying to look at both the negatives and the positives. The positive is that the members explicitly said the international community has a duty to assist countries that are adversely affected by climate change. And so this is really significant, triggered with the fact that it might, so this was clearly stated in the views of the Human Rights Committee, it might trigger states' non-refoulement obligations. So that is sort of an expansive approach to non-refoulement. And so, as one of the experts says, so Yuval Shani says, it does provide the basis for setting new standards and for expanding the scope of refugee, of the notion of refugee. So that's why it's been said to offer potential. But why is it problematic? Because, as I was saying before, it's focused on imminence. And leading scholars like Foster and McAdam criticize it because it is inadequate for climate change litigation, given that there is likely to be some interval of time between actions which could or do violate human rights obligations and the ensuing impacts. So what they argue is that the focus should be instead on the foreseeability of the harm rather than the imminence of the harm. So one, severity of the harm combined with the foreseeability and the vulnerability of the individual. So foreseeability of the harm and vulnerability of the individual concerned. Because otherwise, applicants will never succeed. You know, they will always have to prove an imminent risk to their life, and they are likely to fail. So, as I say here, it will be very difficult to prove personal specificity of the harm. So, as I was saying earlier, and I think you will agree there, the fact that he has, in that case, still 10 or 15 years before things escalate to a point where, yes, it does become uninhabitable, I think is really subject to criticism. But if we want to conclude sort of on this decision on a more positive note, it has to be acknowledged that it was recognised that climate change events can be a valid ground for refugee status. So we will see what is going to happen. But then to conclude, so this is my my very last point. Besides the complexities of conceptualization, which leave us with what I say here, you know, a Hamletian dilemma, the focus should go back to what was said earlier of international cooperation. So there has to be a change of narrative, a change of discourse in relation to migration of recipient countries. So both sending and recipient countries have to benefit from an international framework of cooperation which acknowledges the nexus between climate change, sustainable development measures and migration. And so when I say a change of narrative, what I'm referring to concretely is conceiving migration also as a form of adaptation. So this is already happening, for example, in the context of the International Organization for Migration. You know, if you read their documents, they've been stressing this for a long, long time, and they suggest that migration should be mainstreamed across different policies. And in fact, that would offer, you know, more possibilities, also in relation to protecting climate-induced migrants, because the focus is not just as they say in England, you know, silos, right? So you have refugee in one is one category, then you have other migrants. You know, you would have a more all-encompassing notion. And that brings me to what I said at the start, the notion of the principle of common concern of humankind. Now, this is a principle that, as I said, has been amply used in international environmental law. So this was the first convention that made explicit reference to that, but now, you know, there are other international conventions that refer to it, and the Paris Agreement as well recognizes climate-induced migration. And why am I sort of suggesting to link common concern of humankind to migration? Because migration, like environmental problems, is transboundary. And it can be considered as a problem affecting public goods. And therefore, my argument is that it can be used as a foundation for establishing an international framework for climate migration. Linking it to, as I say here, so not just abstract, but making it concrete by linking it to United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And here I want to give some examples. Think about the SDG 6 on clean water and sanitation, or SDG 7 on affordable and clean energy, SDG 13 on climate action, and SDG 15 on life on land. These are all relevant goals with targeted measures that are relevant to climate-induced migrants. And why am I suggesting this? Because it would help, first of all, it would impose so-called erga omnes obligations for states, both sending and recipient countries. But also because it would help them concretely to devise more credible long-term solutions for climate migrants. And so specifically, my suggestion there would be a combination, you know, a policy mix of existing hard law provisions, you know, treaties, conventions, combined with a more soft law measures that we can find, for example, in the global compacts, the one on refugees or the one on migrants. Okay, so that's the end of my presentation, and I look forward to comments or questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Samantha. It was really the very moving what you were saying about the phenomenon globally, but also the case of Teitiota. I'm sure some of us will have questions for you. I think Federica?
Yes,
she already
something that comes to my mind, but I want to be last,
but,
not first.
First of all, from the doctorate, would you like to make some comments?
Yeah. Even if you disagree, for example, with this suggestion, or because I think it's a dilemma, isn't it? Refugee or not refugee? You know, it's there are valid arguments for remaining traditional.
Yeah.
Which I didn't mention, but
So Federica, you go first.
I go first, but I'm hoping first, not just one. No, because I was thinking that clearly the problem is there; it's objective, but the protection of refugees is specific, and in international law, it is very specific, especially because it goes exactly the other way around, in the opposite way from the normal protection of human rights, because normally protection of human rights is on the shoulders of the state, of the nations, of the state, of the citizen, let's say. And this is the, and when international law comes in, is to force the state respect its obligations towards its own citizens. Okay. While this is the only case where the international protection is going against the state of citizenship, because the protection is exactly against a specific action of the state. And so this means that I think that this kind of protection must stay specific. For refugees, okay. Only for refugees, yeah, yeah, clearly. Yeah. While we need another kind of protection for, very probably stronger than the one that now exists, for this kind of migrants, let's say, that have such a very serious reasons, a reason to come away from their state. But there is an issue. The issue is that the attitude of the state, of these people, because clearly, if the state has if we compare the two things, and we give other states the right, let's say, to take in these people, mm-hmm. away from their state of origin, in a way, okay? Yeah. And so this means that we are deciding that state is going to die, okay? Okay, we are deciding especially if it is a very small state, okay? And people are fleeing from that state. So this is exactly why solutions for these cases should be by agreement. So in international law, it's clear that you cannot compare the two things unless the state from where they are coming is acknowledging that there is no way out. And so we have to relocate, in a way, these people in another state. And so it's dying. So it's for sure that I will no longer exist. I'm accepting it. We are looking for agreed solutions. Maybe we should have a major protection for these people, for human rights reasons, clearly. Having some way of saying that there is, we cannot say an obligation to conclude an agreement, as you know. So, but anyway, it should be agreed. Because otherwise we're going against the idea that states are equal in international law, and their obligations are, first of all, for their territory and citizens. And so we are going against the very rule that is for the protection of human rights is essential in international law for a number of reasons, but also for the protection of human rights. So that's why I think that while a stronger protection is certainly needed, but the specificity of the protection for refugees should stay there, because otherwise that specific case would be diluted.
That is the counter argument for assigning refugee status to climate induced migrants.
We can speak very probably as of a refugee like status, meaning that it should be as strong as, but different in the premises, in the reasoning, in the way out, let's say.
Yes, no, and in fact, that's what as I was saying at the start, that's what the UN Refugee Agency is doing. You know, it refers to refugee-like situations so that it can include different categories while respecting the differences between them. But I think that the complexity of defining them as environmental refugees is that it doesn't capture the multidimensional problems that they have. So, they might be asylum seekers, but at the same, because, you know, they might be fleeing also for political reasons. You know, it's,
that's a different.
I know, clearly. But the problem is that you can't separate them. You can separate them in a scholarly way, but when you have to examine a case, when the authorities have to sit down and say, "Who are you?" Mm-hmm. You know, it becomes very challenging with regard to environmental migrants. Because if you think, for example, in Africa, you know, in the Horn of Africa, we know, sadly, you know, that there are a lot of ethnic, you know, based conflicts. So then they're separating the status of refugee from that of forcibly displaced person because of climate change becomes very difficult. That's what I'm saying. You know, that's the challenge. And so, you know, I haven't mentioned it, but, you know, there have been people already 20 years ago suggesting a new treaty, you know, to have a new treaty with a clear definition of who is an environmental migrant or refugee. But the precise reason why people disagree, for example, Professor McAdam is one of them, is because then you do not allow for nuanced situations to be considered, right? That you remove the flexibility. You know, once you have something written in set in stone, then the problem is you keep someone out. And so for her, the solution is to leave it essentially to the jurisprudence, right? To and to international cooperation, obviously. So a mix of policy, judicial and legal measures. And I think, I mean, what is significant is, you know, you were talking about, you know, recipient countries, sending countries, you know, the COPs, you know, the one that is, you know, the coming up shortly, you know, they've already started to address climate displacement issues, but the problem is that they don't keep up to the promises, right? So they meet and they make promises that then no one meets, and by they I am referring to global north countries. And in fact, it's not surprising that a country like Fiji, for example, I should say, you know, the island of Fiji has been really really an advocate of pushing for climate displacement to be an issue in these COPs, particularly that of 2017, for example. And what is already happening is that these countries are cooperating. You know, these island states are already helping each other. So, you know, Marshall Island has been helping Fiji. And even in that regard, there has been a suggestion to come up with a very broad notion of statelessness, so that people can be defined stateless. Obviously, not everyone will agree, but some international lawyers are already coming up with ideas of having stateless persons who do not, who still maintain a territory, but they cannot live on it, right? So it breaks the idea, the traditional idea in public international law, that, you know, you have to have a territory, you have to have a sovereign state. If you lose it, then you become stateless, right? If you cannot be associated. But because of what is happening with these Pacific islands, there are new suggestions, you know, coming from people like Koskinemni, for example. Yes, I mean, he's not always popular, is he? But of breaking with notions of territory to try and help people who come from these islands, you know, who are forced to leave these islands. So I think what the presentation shows is that it's a bit like opening Pandora's box, you know. There isn't really a one-size-fits-all, but definitely I think it has gathered momentum. So I think it's pretty much, you know, a parallel can be drawn with the new right to a healthy environment. You know, the Parliament Assembly of the Council of Europe has proposed a new protocol on the right to a healthy environment. And I think that raises hope in that regard, because possibly it might be better to have a protocol attached rather than a new treaty, because in that way you can use the jurisprudence that has been developed so far in relation to specific rights, like the ones we know, Article 2, 3, combined with, say, Article 8 or Article 13 of the European Convention, to then link it to the right to a healthy environment, which then, if you look at the notion given by the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, really includes different aspects. And so that could be used, my argument, in the years to come to help sustain claims, maybe based on non-refoulement, together with the right to a healthy environment for climate migrants. So, you know, I think there has to be some creativity from the courts.
Certainly it has to come from the courts. Certainly the flexibility of these instruments is essential in these not new phenomena, but certainly phenomena which were not kept in mind when those instruments were thought of. So certainly the flexibility, this is a very much needed. Other questions?
Ricardo. Just one insight, maybe not the flexibility of the written instrument, but perhaps the reflected customary rule. One can interpret the non-refoulement principle extensively in order to apply to the sea level rise. I don't know, maybe also for statehood, for example, one state can disappear not only for political reasons but also for sea level rise. So one can apply the correspondent customary rule on creation and recognition of statehood to those new situations, perhaps.
Yes, no, I think that's a very good point. I agree entirely, because then it would bind any country in the world because of its customary nature.
Yeah, of course.
But this leads to the fact that clearly the situation of very small island states is very different from the one of big states that are suffering droughts, for instance, but they are not disappearing at all, that's for sure.
I agree. See, yes, in fact, I was really thinking that whether this specific case of Teichiota has some so specific features that one can hardly build on it very much. So in Africa, certainly there are many countries where there are phenomena of desertification that pushes people to flee. But as you said before, very often the movements of these migrants is possibly not only induced by the climate changes, but also by political, by local fights and civil wars, etc. So this is a specific, because there was no such a problem at all. And also another specific feature is that Teichiota, he only moved to New Zealand because it was the big state nearby. He didn't come across other states which had would have caused even more difficulties.
Probably.
So which state is to be considered in charge of dealing with this climate change migration? Yeah. So
a lot of good questions.
Very good questions.
Yes, answers are harder to find.
Just the beginning, the beginning of it. Yes, yes. So I don't see anybody else wanting to intervene. So the time is such that we could maybe consider this event finished. I thank Samantha Velluti again. It was very clear. It was very. Yeah, it really, I think it makes all of us think very, very hard about these new problems or recent problems, this problem of the racing oceans, it is.
Of course, Kenyan proposal is really interesting. It would push us back in history, where we had some, let's say, Western states who had their own government on their own citizens within another state. Well, I think it's not working. Yeah. For every day, for
Samantha, thank you very much. We'll be seeing you again
in December
for another very interesting conversation. And thank you for everybody, and see you soon.